Not just your imagination running away with you. Yes, this is Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program for the African Sisters Media Network, and that is Renee Marie. Just My Imagination, as you probably have not heard it sung before, on her latest CD, and I am playing it because we have a wonderful woman who has a great imagination, Kim McMillan, joining us in the studio. Good morning, Kim. How are you?
Oh, hey, Wanda. I'm doing great. It's always wonderful hearing your voice.
Well, we're happy to have you with us. It's always a great, you always have great news because you are such a proponent of the arts, particularly literary arts here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we're so happy that you are with us and you haven't decided to move to New York or leave the country or something like that. And you have, you're producing a really wonderful event this weekend, a free event at that, the Oakland Public Library and the Women's National Book Association in conjunction, or doing this in conjunction
right.
with yourself, Writers on Writing, and that's on Saturday, July 14th from 12 to 2 at the Rockridge Branch Library. So why don't you tell us about this event that you are hosting this weekend and who's a part of this, you know, Writers on Writing, these women writers on writing.
Well, here's a list of, by the way, thank you for having me on your show, Wanda. I really appreciate it. The list of authors includes award-winning Australian author and journalist Stephanie Dale, and she's going to talk about finding your inner voice, because when she basically walked from Rome into the Balkans, dodging landmines, and then into the Middle East, she kept a journal about the experience, and she has a program that she calls Song for the Soul, which she helps you to find that inner soul writing. Mm-hmm. And then we also have poet and composer Judith Cody, and Judith is a brilliant composer, and she's also working on Penn Oakland's anthology. She's the editor of Fighting Words, which should be coming out at the very end of this year. And then Teresa Leon Ryan, who helps you create your own writing platform to build your brand as a writer, so that when people see your name, they know what you're about. They know your writing style, just like when anyone sees the name that's terrible. But some of those writers that write about spy novels, you know, Grisham, who write a certain genre, when you see their name, you know what they're going to be about. And so mm-hmm. she helps you brand yourself, as many writers already branded. And then we have a wonderful columnist. Her name is Yolanda Barrio. And she is going to help you find your passion as a writer. And so this is a very interactive workshop. And then there is finally Joan Gelfin, who will basically deconstruct the whole process of how to get published.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of this workshop is to find your voice and give substance to your voice and the actions that you need to take to get your voice out into the public.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wonderful. And you're actually a writer yourself. You have over 20 years experience producing theater in the Bay Area. And in 1987, there was a Ken MacMillan event where you wrote, produced, and directed Voyages, a multimedia excursion into reincarnation at UC Berkeley's Zellerbach Playhouse. And that's a great story that I hope you tell us. And then in 2000, you wrote and produced Confessions of a Thespian, When Spirit and Theater Collide at the Julia Morgan Theater in Berkeley, and I was in the audience for that. And from 2001 to 2005, you produced the Oakland Literature Expo with Penn Oakland as part of the City of Oakland's Art and Soul Festival. And that was really wonderful. Are you still doing that? Because Art and Soul is coming up early August in Oakland.
No, I haven't worked with Art and Soul. I love the people there, but my whole picture is that I'm an advocate for writers and probably a little crazed about it. And the City of Oakland was wonderful, but we're always changing locations. Mm-hmm. And so when I work with a group, I really want to them to know that, you know, I've got your back. And I will make sure that you're seen, that you're heard. And they're wonderful, but I think writers need to have their own venue. Mm-hmm. We do not need to come in on anyone else's venue. Because we have to be, as writers, we have to be the center of our universe. And whenever you're in the middle of someone else's universe, you have to play by their rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so as writers, I really commend local writers, anything that they can do to promote each other, to work in unison, to work as a group, and to support the dissemination of information on the whole process of writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this past weekend there was this really great event. Rafael Jesus
sent
an email about it. Yeah, it looked really interesting. I wasn't able to go. Let me tell you what it was called. It looked really fascinating. It was sort of like a marathon, and then afterwards there was a party.
Wow,
which sounded really fun.
Great.
Yeah, and it might have been free. I'm not sure, but. Yeah, Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, he just does some really remarkable work with keeping writing and literature out in the forefront. I remember he was a part of this Writing in Nature event earlier this year, like in the spring. And this one here, it had an interesting kind of mechanism, I think there was like a crane or something on the flyer. I'll come back to that as you... you talk more about your own work. And currently you are working on a stage adaptation of the Brazilian director Carlos, how do you pronounce Carlos's last name?
Diegues. Well, it's
Diegues.
Been kind of hard because the process I'm working with, it's funny, I had Eleanor Holdridge, who is the head of drama.
Let's finish first because people might not know Carlos Diegues, 1984 film Quilombo, Dos Palmares, on 17th century slavery in Brazil. And then, you know, I want to let people know also that you host a radio show called Arts in the Valley, and it can be heard on 1480 KYOS AM in California's San Joaquin Valley, as well as on Facebook. And
I do want to give Carlos his props, as you said, because when I was I first started looking at and seeing Carlos's work, when I saw this incredible film called Chica de Silva in 1976, where they have this black woman who had such sexual prowess. And Carlos is a Brazilian filmmaker. And she was supposed to be able, she was an African slave in this time, it was an 18th century African slave, and she was supposed to have this sexual ability. And it's a romanticized telling of a true story of an actual character. What I like about Carlos is he takes actual history. And the history, the true history, Chica da Silva, she was actually a slave that attracted attention from some very high up people. But in this, in the retelling of it, they made her where men could not resist her. And of course, as an African American woman, I love this tale. I was like, yes, finally someone understands the power of blackness, mm-hmm. so to speak. And he also wrote another, wrote and directed another movie that I really, really like, Bye Bye Brazil. So he's done some major work. And when I had first had started having conversations with Carlos in the, let me see, in the early 2000, around 2006, early 2006, you know, he says, Kim, you have so much passion about everything. Why don't you take my work? Because I told him that when I first saw Quilombo, it was the first movie that I ever saw on slavery. Oh, sorry. I was actually playing his music. but I saw on slavery that just, I forgot where I was. And I just it was the idea of a group of black people so empowered that they could create a state, an actual community, palmares, in a world of slavery, where they were empowered, where they had power, where they were powerful, and that was just amazing. And then you read more about African history in the entire diaspora, and you realize that this wasn't the only one; it was the most famous. Where black people in during slavery created a community where they were in power, but this was the most famous. But this was happening all over the world, including in the Americas. Excuse me, including in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And right, so, yeah. And he actually has been here. He was a part of San Francisco Jazz Festival. I remember I invited you, but you were busy.
Hey, and you didn't tell me.
It was so fantastic, and I got a chance to meet him and his son. It was really like, wow.
How long ago was this?
Oh, must have been 2 years ago.
Oh,
yeah,
because
you like
I
went back and forth.
It.
Yeah, you were busy because you're always so busy. And he's like, okay, I want to go.
But next time, tell me.
Oh.
I haven't really talked to him lately. It's like I'm always like you
I
know,
mentioned you
like,
to him when I
always
when
thought
I got
I'm going
to
be
high.
Just close to doing the movie, or I mean, excuse me, finishing the adaptation or getting something done. But right now, I was talking to Professor Selman at Howard about doing this in collaboration with a Catholic university, and he said, well, you have to cut out a lot of it, perhaps use music to move it along because it's so long. And so now I'm trying to write music and shorten it, because at the rate it is now, it's probably about 4 hours.
Well, opera is long. I remember a few of the stage versions, one here at the College of Alameda and the other one at Laney College, and I got a chance to be in the one at Laney.
You were wonderful.
And you're so kind. And both were just, the piece always gets, you know, such accolades and attention because people don't know this story about the insurrection, and that's
right.
Why the movie is so wonderful, because it's where African people of African descent are dignified and they have integrity and they want liberation, and that's what's so wonderful about the tale. And then you know the way you reinterpret it. It's just really fantastic.
Well, now I'm actually doing even more reinterpreting. I think I've talked to Carlos about it because I've had so many professor types, you know, the whole issue of Congo, Nigerian, use of Yoruba as opposed to Bantu religion. Mm-hmm. And so now I've actually created more of a mixture, and I'm bringing in more of the historical religions that were that were in that time period, rather than what Carlos did, which was give it more of a Yoruba flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually been talking to John Thornton. He wrote this incredible book. If you have an interest in Africans and what happened during the, probably from 1585 to 1660 with Africans and the slave trade, read John Thornton's Central Africans, Atlantic Creoles, and the Foundation of the Americas. It's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Anything by John Thornton. He's a credible scholar on what really was taking place in the Congo.
Yes, yeah, spell his last name for us.
Oh, sure. It's Thornton. And he writes with his wife, Linda M. Haywood, Heywood. And I got his name from a professor at UC Berkeley, who told me that he was a scholar I needed to speak to. Mm-hmm. But that professor was G. Ugu, I believe it's Wagiji. And
oh,
he
yeah.
is associate professor in the Department of African American Studies at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm feeling very lucky because I will be taking a course from him on Monday nights in the fall on the African diaspora. And I'm just like, I just found out today, I'm just so thrilled because I feel like it will help me understand that whole period better. His class is African Before European Conquest.
Mm, wow.
And I'm
well,
like,
how might
wow.
I be joining you, Kim? That sounds fascinating.
Oh, my goodness, because we're always told just, you know, what is what or who is, you know, we're always told who we are as African Americans,
mm-hmm.
you know, or where we came from. But to have a history that we don't know, that we have people of African descent or people who are scholars on African history, because you don't have to be of African descent, you just have to love this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's nice when there's a combination.
Oh, well, either way, but to me, it's love, to understand the importance. It wasn't until I started studying, doing my graduate work and studying, reading the slave narratives and mm-hmm. studying the history, African history, that I really understood that as an African, you think, okay, you could be 5-10 years old and you think, slavery, whatever happened, that has no connection to me anymore because not only am I free, but I'm living in a world without apartheid. I'm living in a world without Jim Crow laws. We're living in the United States without Jim Crow, but your life is still affected by that past.
Mm-hmm.
And it behooves any African American to study that past, to really understand your DNA, what you're really about. Because it's like your ancestors will continually call you. They are continually with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like paying homage to who you are. It's okay to say, okay, I'm not interested in it, but to know that that's, whether you like it or not, it's a part of who you are. And for people to dismiss slavery and basically the historical impact on African Americans and also on white people or people who understand, who actually were a part of that history. I remember I went to a lecture a couple of months ago by Cecil Brown, and Cecil talked about how he met the people who enslaved his family. I believe it was North or South Carolina. They still had the papers. I mean, they still had the slave. She went down in the attic and got the slave papers.
Mm, the bill of sale.
Yeah, the bill of sale. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Hmm.
You know, and they had a museum, but she still had the papers down in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, how close is that?
Yeah.
And then his relatives look like her family because, of course, black people didn't have a choice. You know, a black woman at that time period, she would say, "No, master, I really don't want to have sex with you." And it was basically too bad. So he has relatives that look exactly like her side of the family. And so they all met in a room. Mm-hmm. And they just talked. I think that probably was a very enlightening experience.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And you think about, you know, what happened. I mean, people of African descent, Africans basically built the wealth of Western culture. So everyone benefits from this free labor that took place over three, four centuries, and except the ones that were working and not building up, you know, capital for their descendants, which are the black people, us. Mm-hmm. And so everyone, you know, it's not just black history, it's world history, it's American history.
Completely.
Everyone needs to know about this because it affects all of us to a great degree.
And one of the things you can do, if you don't know where you've come from, you can't heal the pain pictures because mm-hmm. you're looking behind you and going, "What's that pain picture behind me?" And it's you. But if you're going to completely ignore your, you know, there has to be a lot of forgiveness, a lot of acknowledgement, and then a moving forward. Mm-hmm. Because it's like holding a child on your back and not realizing, why do I feel so burdened? Because you're carrying your history and have not acknowledged it. The minute you acknowledge it, accept it, forgive, I think you can take that child off your back mm-hmm. because it no longer has a power to hold you back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, yeah. And that's just how I feel about it. It doesn't mean it's right. It's just how I feel about it.
Mm. Well, there's definitely a whole lot to be said about you know, bringing forth that which is giving one, you know, sort of this unacknowledged grief.
Yeah.
And once you extricate or sort of take this out of yourself and put it in front of you so you can address it and so you can see it, then all the energy, you know, sort of dissipates because all it wanted was to be acknowledged.
And sometimes I really think that's true. You know, we hear about the New Age stuff in the Bay Area where you go to this whole New Age place. You very seldom see African Americans at these places, but I've gone to them. And you'll sit in the room and someone will say to you, "I want you to acknowledge the child within. I want you to say hello to that child and ask it what's it need." Now, you know, because I'm like a crybaby, I'll cry at these types of things. You know, some other person might laugh. I'm like, "Yeah, I got to acknowledge that child." But there is something to be said about acknowledging that part of you, you know, the forgotten child. Mm-hmm. Louise Hay does great work around that in her books, like, you know, healing the body. And I like that.
And you can heal yourself.
It's
one of her bestsellers.
Yeah,
and we can heal ourselves.
Stuff.
Yeah. And it starts with affirmations, which means you're acknowledging that something exists.
Completely,
and then,
the great things, and I'm doing a lot of my graduate work on that, what I love about the black, you know, arts movement, because it was acknowledging, you remember the time, we're close to the same age, where you'd go out, walk around and you'd be colored or you'd be Negro, but the minute you walk down the street, and I remember coming to the mainland from Hawaii, and leaving Hawaii, and black people with big afros on the street, this was like 1971, throwing the black power fist. And I was like, as a kid, I was 11 years old, I'm going, wow. So it's like, wow, what happened to black people? You know, where did I miss this? I loved it. It was like a celebration. Being African American, and I actually, like I will say to anyone, I love black because it's like it encompasses so much. African American is a nice saying, but from going to people being embarrassed about their color to going to I am black, I am dark, I am light, I am magnificent. And that was being fed through theater, through the Black Panthers, through revolutionary papers, newspapers, to a whole nother look at blackness. that we just did not have in the early 60s, 50s, whatever. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of people felt like, well, you know, you got to do the best you can because y'all know you got black blood and you are dark and all that. But to, like, celebrating whatever you are, is celebrating your blackness. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think there should be more of that. I think people should be dancing in the streets and celebrating who I am. If you're white, go celebrate your whiteness. I don't really care. You know, I just think people should be celebrating who they are. And there's so much damage done to me, the black soul, that it needs to be celebrated. And that's when people say, well, we don't celebrate white or whatever. It's like, you know, has your soul been damaged by hundreds of years of slavery? And if you feel like it has, then go celebrate. Or if you feel like it's been damaged by whatever, go celebrate that. You know, you got to heal yourself. Everyone has to heal themselves in the way they know best. Mm-hmm. And whatever you need to do, I'm not about to stop a person from saying they need to heal themselves. As long as they keep their healing, as long as their healing basically does not affect my livelihood, my life. Whatever you need to do to heal yourself, I say go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And you know, when one looks at the search for the thespian, you know, your two-part piece that you did.
Oh, yeah.
That had a lot of these kinds of aspects or themes running through it. Isn't that correct?
Well, yeah, because, and to me, that was healing yourself as an artist. You know, how many of us have sat and been told by society at large that as an artist you are ridiculous? Do not even think you could make it as an artist. Do not even, you know, whatever. I feel like if you want to say to an artist, well, it's always good to have something to fall back on, but I want to celebrate your art too. I think that's wonderful. But to go about and deny that person's artistic life because you don't feel that somehow it's worthy, I feel like is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people do not see the value in art. They don't understand that what is saved from millions and thousands of years, what do we see written on walls and caves? We see art. Mm-hmm. You know, what transforms us? It's art. But yet, how much we see the NEA, we see people taking money away from the arts. We see that it's being devalued. Mm-hmm. When actually, I think art should be embraced. I remember teaching kids at Lockwood Elementary School, and the kids just soaking the art up. I wrote a short play for them, and we used a whole third grade class. And one of the kids that had dyslexia, and the teacher, the principal said, before you came, he spent every single day in the office. But when he saw the theater, when he saw that he could be an excellent actor, he stopped. He made sure that he did the best he could so he didn't have to spend his time in the principal's office. And you know how he learned his lines? The teacher would repeat them back to him because he couldn't really read. Mm. He had his lines memorized better than any single person in the entire class. And that just shows you the power of art.
Wow.
To transform lives.
Wow. That is awesome.
People need to understand that. Don't take money away from art. Do not take, that's like taking a person's arm or their person's limb and saying you'll be okay without it. Sure, you'll be okay without it, but your functionality, how you function, can be at its best because you had both arms. Mm-hmm. And to me, art is like food. It's like an arm. It should never be taken away. There should be ways found to use it. I one of my professors, Dr. Nigel Hatton, teaches at San Quentin, and he talked about how this class at San Quentin, these hardened criminals, they are transformed through this, through literature. And we put people in prisons, and we don't understand that eventually they come out. And if you don't have something healing to give to them, they're not going to come out whole and healed. They're going to come out, if you batter and abuse people in prison and you expect them to somehow come out in society and say, okay, I'm going to act normal now. The best thing we can do for people in prison is to give them art, to give them ways to help heal themselves so that they, when they go out, they're thinking about how can I heal others.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think I told you that there's a Shakespeare at San Quentin and this year. I saw Hamlet, and it's facilitated through the Marin Shakespeare Company. They produce many seasons. I saw last year they did a play. I saw last year was a comedy, and this year was a tragedy. And then what happens is the men do a side by side type of play. They write a play about their characters, but relating it to their lives, and then they're going to perform that in August. So they performed Hamlet in, I think that was June or May, and then they're going to perform their own Hamlet in August. And I just think you're right. One of the comments was that when they step into a role, they get to be somebody else. They get to transform themselves.
Mm-hmm. And you see the difference. You see, Nigel talks about how this is the transformative quality, and how these people, these men, are so excited. It's called the, let me see, the Prison University Project. I think the name, Jody, I'm not sure what their last name is the one who runs it, and I'm hoping to have her on my radio show in August, because I love this idea. I truly believe that our prison system should be for rehabilitation.
Certainly. And a woman that you know really well has joined us, Javelin Richards.
Hey, Javelin, how are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's so nice hearing from you. Javelin is an excellent actress. Excellent. And in fact, has a show this weekend.
Right, yeah. It's going to just be a power-packed full weekend with two wonderful women facilitating some real transformation through our imaginations and also getting some skills in your workshop, Kim. And what I mentioned earlier with regards to Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, the event was called Oakland's first Beast Crawl Citywide Poetry Event, which was last Saturday, July 7th, and it started early, and they had like different legs of the journey. 5 to 6, you were in one place, and then with different groups of riders, and then it ended up at Club Paradiso for a party. So it was really fun, yeah. And Kim, why don't you give us the details again about the event on Saturday that you are hosting.
Oh, sure. It's Saturday at the Oakland Public Library, Rockbridge Branch. The location is 5366 College Avenue. You can get off at the Rockbridge BART station and just walk over to it. It starts at 12 noon. It goes to 2 p.m. Let me get the phone number. You can also call me. My phone number is 510-681-5652. But it's just a lovely event. We're going to have a little bit of food because it's at 12 noon, and we don't want people to leave and say, they didn't have any food and they didn't feed us anything. But it's going to be a totally fun event.
Yeah, and it's free, too, which is really wonderful.
Completely free, and it's to be supportive of community and to support the libraries and to support wonderful writers and to help other people basically with learning the craft of writing.
Right, yeah.
Oh, should I be going now? Because I don't know
We're going to shift over and to Javelin, and I want to let you know before you go, Kim, that also tonight, it started yesterday, Luis Rodriguez is actually in town. His book, his book, his last book, It Calls You Back, is in paperback. It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. And then he's on tour with another book, this one here he's editor of. It's called Rushing Waters, Rising Dreams, How the Arts Are Transforming a Community. And there's a film connected to that. And so today at the San Francisco Main Library on Larkin, they're having a screening and conversation from 12 to 3. And then tomorrow at Modern Times Books, they're having another. He's going to be showing the film and also having a discussion, a reading from 6 to 8:30, and these are all free. But tonight, which is why I wanted to mention it to you, tonight at Art International Gallery and Art Lounge on 961 Pacific in San Francisco, there's a poet's party and joint reading with Eugene B. Redman, who is the editor for Drum Voices Review. He's here from East St. Louis.
Wonderful.
And the Revolutionary Poets Brigade. So they're all going to be together. And Eugene Redman is going to be reading along with Jack Hirschman, Devorah Major, Q.R. Hand, Luis Rodriguez, and Michael War. It's going to be, oh, my God.
That will be off the hook.
Yeah, and it's going to be music by Keenan Webster on the African Korand and Layla and Rondo on vocals and guitar, and there's going to be food and drink, and donations suggested, but no one turned away. So this sounds like it's going to be the party. Oh, my goodness.
Completely. Although I live 3 hours away and won't be there, I'll be there in spirit. But thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate you and the show, Wanda.
Oh, well, thank you, Kim. It was a great conversation, and looking forward to seeing you on Saturday. I'm going to move everything out of the way because those women, I need to be in their presence.
Okay. Take care, Javelin. Bye.
You too. I'll see you this weekend. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, wow, Javelin Richards, you have another show.
Yes,
and
I do.
It's a part of the Garages Raw, which is kind of cool, resident artist workshop. And it's called Stripping Down to Story. And it's
Stripping
written and performed by you as all of your work. And you've been on our show. You're like one of our favorite guests.
You've
been on talking about all different work, and it's all solo work. And it was funny what you said yesterday about about why you grew up in a large family.
I'm one of eight kids, and so I think coming out of that experience, I cannot work with groups of people. As I did my time with my family, it was beautiful. I love them deeply, but I prefer to be with myself.
That's funny. I did my time with my family.
I did. It was wonderful, but it taught me to appreciate solitude, and that's where, you know, in terms of reading, I would five brothers and two sisters, then myself. It gave me the space to really get involved with reading, to have a sense of my own identity. Mm-hmm. It's very hard in a large family to discover who you are and what does it really mean. Mm-hmm. So out of that, I would read, and I would, you know, just as you and Kim was talking about, I turned to art to get a sense of my own understanding. And since that journey, I've learned to really engage and realize that I was born a storyteller, but that can get really confusing when you're one of eight kids. So you have this one child, meaning me, that's running around telling stories all the time, making up stuff, seeing stuff that no one else sees, not knowing that I'm a storyteller and I have those properties inside of me, ancient properties, as I say, from the ancestors. So I have that in me. Well, eight children, my mother just saw me as a pathological liar because I was always making up stuff. So that to her was like, here's this brown child running around making up stuff every few minutes, keeping her brothers and sisters up late at night telling them stories. So I eventually went into my own solitude so I wouldn't get a whooping. So I became very quiet as a child, and I read a lot and identified with characters, and it just felt I found myself, and then I realized, oh my gosh, this is what I am. I am a storyteller. So I work as a solo artist.
So when did you discover that your name for what you do?
I think I was around 13, and we were going to private school, and again, I had been in trouble a lot for making up stuff in class. I couldn't stay on task. What that meant was I would make up stories about other teachers to the children on the playground. So I'd make up these stories instead of playing jump rope or whatever else game. I would tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the nuns had the good sense one day to say to me, why don't you write that down as an essay? Tell us about it in an essay.
Yeah.
And so I did. So then she went to my mother. She said, you know, I believe that you actually have a writer on your hands. That's what's happening for her.
Wow.
And that, and when my mother heard that, it was on many levels a sigh of relief that she did not just have a 13-year-old child headed for trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But she had a child that was actually had a very active imagination and in the world of literature and needed to express it. And then as I moved forward in my life, my work, my craft, my muse took me onto the stage. And that's where I'm at now in writing performance art.
Well, that's interesting how, you know, when one is surrounded by people that are not familiar with sort of like, you know, sort of like the different places that their child could go or just sort of being exposed to enough to know that my child is not lying. My child just has a great imagination. Not having those that kind of language or not having that kind of linguistic access or even to be able to even go there because maybe they were shut down. You know, when they were a child, because all children, I think, have very extremely vivid imaginations. You just happen to be able to articulate what you were thinking, you know, in such a way that was captivating to your siblings. But that's amazing that you, until 13, you were sort of like kind of displaced as a person.
Yeah, displaced and trying to figure it out. Because it would have been easier for my mother had I opened my mouth and sang. And then she said, oh, my God, this baby has a beautiful voice.
Right.
It would have been easier for my mother if someone had played some music and I'd have started dancing and it was different and more powerful maybe than my siblings, then someone might have said, oh, my God, this child's a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been different had I been running home and was exceeding the levels of science or math, and they said, oh, my God, this child is really intelligent. You can identify that because we want that. We want that for our children, those traditional ways in the world. But to have a child to sit in a room of grown-ups, for instance, and this is one of the earlier memories I had, my mother had a friend named Miss Josephine, and Miss Josephine would come by to visit, and I knew that they were close, because if my mother poured coffee for you, you were close, and I knew they were going to be right. If there was a coffee, if the coffee pot was going, I know the person that was coming by, that they were going to have grown-up conversations. So Miss Josephine never really talked a lot. She did a lot of things like So I would then write stories to her and so I would tell and so I would make up what that really meant. And I would tell that story to my siblings when we would play outside. And I said, well, you know what Miss Josephine really was saying to Mom? And they go, what? And I say, well, she was saying, I was filling all the blanks. And then they would go, And I go, yeah. And then it became like a sing-song kind of a game. And when my mother would overhear that, and she would say, come in the house, come here. She says, why did you say that about Miss Josephine? And I would go, I don't know, because I didn't know. And then she said, you can't make up things about grown people. And then I would get in trouble. But then later I was able to understand that filling in the blank is a person, a writer, walking into an empty space and being able to see things that are wanting to be there, like a person, a cup, a table, curtains blowing on a window. So their imagination brings you into the story. And that's what I, you know, I realized that part of it. But my mom couldn't identify that.
Right.
And And even to this day, when I visit with my family, when I go, it's another way in which we bonded as children, and they know exactly where I'm going down that path until our childhood and those sounds. And then it also evokes the memory of Miss Josephine, who's no longer on the planet, but it brings her back into the center, and it has sentimental value now.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you are a writer, solo performance artist. You have a master's in fine arts. You're also a stand-up comedian, professional storyteller, guest lecturer. Are you still a co-producer for KPFA Women's Magazine?
No, actually, I'm still at KPFA, but I'm doing cover-to-cover open book every third Friday at 3 o'clock.
Are you?
Third Arts
third
and Humanities.
Friday. Friday.
Every third
3
Friday.
3 o'clock?
O'clock.
So when is the third Friday in July?
That would be the 20th.
Okay.
The 20th
of nice.
July.
Nice. Oh, that's cool. I like Cover to Cover. That's a great show.
Yeah,
okay.
Arts and Humanities, which, you know, feels very, and part of that show for me is that I am in search of, in my work and in my life, emotional intelligence. So I try to bring in people who I think their work, whether it's through literature, through music, through theater, through visual arts, that evokes emotional intelligence in me.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think a part of our humanity right now is we're really looking at how to connect to our emotions and how to connect with one another emotionally as a way to move, you know, humanity forward.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're also a co-author of the novel The Onion, and it won the Digest Merit Award. You're author of Raising Autumn, Colored Babies, Beyond Vanity, and various other published works. Your written and stage productions include The Diaries of Aunt Jemima, Harlem Nights, Flowers Cut in a Vase and Dying, and Pussy Will Sell a Lot Longer Than Cotton Any Day. And some of your other work, because I didn't see any of those. Because I've seen, I think I've seen two or
come
three
home.
Of your pieces. Yeah, Come Home. That was really beautiful, and that was looking at veterans from World War II, right?
Yes, black veterans from World War II, told through the story of one of the wives of the men who went off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is told through the voice of Donna Ray and the women and children in that area of Arkansas and the impact of their lives when the men came back from war, and how Donna Ray had to become invisible as a passionate woman in order to survive her marriage, because he could not feel. He could not. He was all emotions had been dissolved from his life. He had seen too much.
Right.
The death of his friends and the racism and war, and he came back empty.
Yes, that was a really beautiful work. You did it over at the Marsh in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
mm-hmm.
really. He had a nice run, too. It wasn't just one day. People could
five
go
weeks.
Back. Yeah.
Right, 5 weeks, it was beautiful, and I was completely spoiled. 3 nights a week on stage?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I was spoiled. That was beautiful.
Yeah, great production too. Lighting, set.
Stephanie
gorgeous.
Oh my gosh, Stephanie Johnson, who we are artistic collaborators, and she's going to be doing this show, Stripping Down to Story. She's going to do the light design for that as well.
Excellent. And then I remember the piece you did. It was a work in progress at La Peña Cultural Center.
Miss Pat's House.
Yes, Miss Pat's House. And then you did it again. You had another Miss Pat's House, and you had some more characters.
Yes.
Yeah, that was really nice.
And
the brothel.
The brothel. It takes place in the brothel. And we're going to have that show again in August, the 13th, and no, the 10th, 11th, and 12th of August.
Mm-hmm. At La Peña?
At La Peña Cultural Center. So that's the 10th, 11th, and 12th.
Okay,
so
and that's La Peña Berkeley. Okay.
Mm-hmm, La Peña Berkeley on Shattuck.
And
I think the calendar is up on their lapena.org's website now.
Right, lapena.org. So is the third edition of Miss Pat's House have any new characters found at a boat? Have any that were there in version one or two moved on?
Well, in this show, the woman who first comes to Miss Pat's house, she ends up in all my shows. Her name is Miss Lucy. Even though in some shows her name changes, it's still the same character. Her name is Miss Lucy. And Miss Lucy is a real person that was in my life as a child who also saw that difference in me. And she was an elder person then, so, and she's passed on. But she's always in every show. No matter what I do, Miss Lucy comes to me spiritually and says, I need to be in the show. And I say, Miss Lucy, this is a brothel. You're 103. I'm not clear what it is you want to do in this brothel. And she says, somebody needs to cook. They have to eat. So she's going to be there. Miss Lily will be there again. She's still working through her pain as a biracial woman.
Okay.
Who loses her identity. She was passing for white, and so she still has her struggle because she's still working it through. The newest character is Sweet Baby.
Sweet Baby.
She's coming to the brothel this year. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sweet
nice.
Baby.
And what about the, I'm trying to think, is it a transvestite?
He was born like in 1901. So we have to imagine African American man, but he was a Negro or colored then, being born in the South. It's the only child, and it's a boy. So he's a boy child. He's able to help his father work the land. And to imagine that he then realizes that he loves men and that he loves dressing in women's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So think about how heavy that sky is that he has to hold up. He has to hold this sky up in the early 1900s, and he's trying. And so, he will be back there this year as well because he's still working out his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the characters are usually passed on in terms of, like, you know, fast forward 21st century, but it's really the energy in which they're working through. So this is looking at gender roles, and it's looking at, in Miss Lucy's case, elder abuse. It's looking at social issues, and the characters sort of walk them through. Like Miss Lily is passing for white and is found out once she has a baby who's dark. So she's still dealing with internalized racism and racism. So if it's still existing in the present time, the characters continue to show up at this brothel to work it through.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds really great, but that's not what's happening this weekend. So tell us about stripping down the story, because it's a literal and figurative use of that word, stripping, right?
Yes, stripping down the story is about a woman named Diane Edwards. And her name is important in that in this place, she is married. She's married to Dr. C. Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
But they only call her Diane Edwards throughout the story. And she's also, it takes place, the story opens in 1933. She's in the medical field. She's practicing in Alabama before her marriage. She then becomes married to him, and they move to Harlem.
Mm.
And what is going on in this particular story is a great deal of internalized racism because she's a dark brown woman, and she's doing the Harlem Renaissance with the Harlem aristocrats. Our lives are blowing up in incredibly beautiful ways, but inside of that, there's a lot of internalized racism, and they can't understand why this man, who's a very, very high yellow man with very fine hair, how he could marry this woman. And then also she's a woman with a medical degree. So then that becomes, we're talking,
we're
talking about, she's educated. So she's dealing with what does that mean to a woman in 1933. So she is stripped of everything as she moves to Harlem and she does not fit in. She cannot sign up for some of the internalized racism and she's targeted both by the men in her field and then by the women who much they prefer being wives of affluent, educated men, and they have no desire to want to be in a profession, even though some of them have degrees. They don't want to use those degrees. They want to be the wife of so-and-so, whoever that is. So she's faced with all of that. And when she loses that her medical license over some BS, all kinds of crazy gossip drama, then she then makes a decision one night with her husband. They have a conversation around skin color, children. She loses it, and she ends up everything has gone out of her life, and she ends up a striptease artist in a very exquisite Negro striptease club in Harlem, and that's where she spends the rest of her life for the most part. But this is one of those journeys where you have one set of plans in life. You say, oh, I'm going to be a doctor, and I'm going to, in her case, I'll be a part of uplifting the Negro race, and I will, and all these great things will happen. But there's another spiritual journey that the universe wants her to go on, and it turns out that this place where she works is somewhat magical, and this is where she finds her true sense of identity, oddly enough. So you have two worlds, and who would have came to her and said, listen, you could be a striptease artist or a doctor, what do you want to be? Most of us would sign up to be a doctor. They'd say, oh my God. And she does sign up for that, but she realizes, and some of us realize, sometimes we are thrust into a different path. And when she's in this striptease club, what happens is that the movements of her hands while she performs nightly to the backdrop of jazz evokes spirits from the other world for people also that have lived very challenging lives to come through her body and to tell their story. So while she's dancing on stage and all these beautiful lights and her body's moving and her hand turns a certain way, if the world stops and someone comes up out of her being and shares their challenging time on the planet, and they've all lost their life. And so, it's, again, dealing with isms, they each had to, like, for instance, there is a man who comes through her body, similar to the man you met with Miss Pat's house. Mm-hmm. He shares his story of loving and loving differently, and how his lover, Willie T., is the one who ends up killing him. Again, homophobia. Mm. Then there's another character. Her name is Forty. She's a twin, and her twin sister did not have enough oxygen to the brain, and so she is born, they said back then, dumb wicked. And again, so we're talking the South. We're talking born in the early 1900s, we're talking Negro. So now we have to think about what were the resources. Mm-hmm. So without resources, that Sauti, it becomes her twin's protector. And when she gets married to this man who she doesn't love, they just live in the country. He likes to drink. She likes to drink. He can take care of her. She has an eighth grade education. She says, I will marry you, but you have to take care of my sister, too. She's coming with me. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that domestic violence, and he ends up killing her with a cast iron, her favorite cast iron. She says, my favorite cast iron skillet. That's what took me out.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I was like, where does this woman, Javelin Richards, find these characters? My goodness gracious, where do they come from? And I also want to mention to our audience that your work, Stripping Down the Story, this one-woman show written by Ms. Javelin Richards, with artistic collaborations by Stephanie Ann Johnson, are you having the live musicians there, Mike Wilson on sax and Dexter Rogers on keyboard? Are they going to be there performing live with you?
Yes, and the music, now Mike will be there, and Dex will not. I now have Patrick, his name is, and Seth, A-N-S-E-T-H, and then J.T. Davis. And And then Kimberly Turner, my vocalist, she'll be there. So
wow, you added two more people. Oh my goodness!
I did. Well,
that's
came to
nice.
Me. We were on the back porch last night rehearsing and having a good time.
Oh, you should have called me. That sounds fun.
I cooked food. It felt so. The characters needed that too. I cooked some really wonderful food. We set out back. They played on the porch, and we could. We call it rehearsal technically, but really for me it's a process of falling in love with each other and the story.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll be on stage with me.
Are they the same people that were, or some of them that were on stage with you when you did? The piece about the veteran.
No, the musicians have changed.
Okay.
And it happens. Like I had a couple musicians that took off for New York. I mean they're creative beings and so I'm just have had a wonderful journey that each time there's a production of a show the right folks come to me and they join in and we learn the story and we have a good time.
Oh yeah, I just want to let our audience know that you know you're a creative person that you know brings in others to collaborate with you. You know, like Stephanie Johnson for the wonderful lighting and you know lighting design. She's really an artist with light. And then you know every now and then, not every show has live music, but it's really cool when it is.
It is. A part of it too is that the musicians. For me, in the beginning, I would say that they were a part of the voice of the ancestors, so that what language cannot do in the moment, it's like, so, like you say, someone says, I love you, and that's beautiful, we get that, but sometimes I love you, and you're just waiting, because something else needs to happen, so it's like, then that sweet note that follows it and go, oh, you love me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that sweet note. It's not necessarily just musically, but it's sometimes for me as the writer, that note is somewhere in our spirit that we just haven't found enough language to put there. So I just try to have that relationship and on stage so that if whatever it is that I was saying that someone didn't quite get, then suddenly they may hear a violin and then they go, oh, my God, I'm having an aha moment, I pray. So that's why I have them on there.
Right.
As a part of our relationship.
Exactly. And that points to your interest in emotional intelligence because we have different ways of ascertaining information and learning things. So some people might be visual, and some might the music might hit them. Some people might be more auditory, or the music combines a few different aspects of our person, and that might hit the way that they are most communicative. And so they might miss the words, but they'll hear it in the violin or the saxophone or the piano or in someone's voice, you know, sort of the pitch of the voice.
Absolutely.
Or the way the voice falls, or the lyrical quality of the note, so everyone will be following you in different ways because you'll be hitting them on a lot of levels, and then or somebody might be into the lighting creates moods, so might get it that way. So so you're employing all of these different. You're in your theater, you're hitting multiple aspects of our intelligence. In one fair scoop because of the way that you have orchestrated this particular journey, stripping down the story, which is happening on Friday and Saturday, July 13th and 14th, 8 o'clock both days at the Garage, which is located at 715 Bryant Street at 5th Street in San Francisco. That sounds like right around Civic Center with BART, which means you can get off and walk. Is it that close?
I think the BART is relatively close. I don't know.
Yeah,
I do know that the parking is fabulous in that area, so that's the good news. And I do know that I think one of my musicians said they were going to take BART, so they had did all the, you know, whatever one does that does BART.
That's Civic Center, I believe.
Okay.
But it could be somewhere else. So don't listen to me. You know. check it out, call Bart or something. And the phone number, I'm sure if you call the garage, they could tell you what the closest Bart station is.
Yes,
the phone number there is 415-518-1517, 415-518-1517. And tickets are pretty reasonable. I saw like $10 to $20 or something like that. I was like, ooh, I might you know, be able to like give you a donation as opposed to ask for a press comp. That's like in my range.
Right. That's so wonderful. Yes, and it's a very intimate setting, which is really sweet.
Oh,
I think it seats 60, which is good for this show.
Oh,
because
nice. 60 is going to be very intimate. 60.
Intimate. And
you can have
that
many people
right
at your house.
Right. It's right. And it's for this show because of the just the, you know, the movement, the intimacy in which I'm trying to hold space for, and the all of the shows that I work with inside Create, our the emotional content is there, but there is that added element that I am in ways, you know, taking on the movements of a striptease artist, although I must say, because someone says, oh, are you going to take your clothes off? No, because the right. Like, I was just my mother, cause certainly she had a hard time dealing with me being a storyteller because she didn't know what it was. But if she found I was in San Francisco taking my clothes off, there's no excuse. She would be, there is no excuse whatsoever. You'd be buck naked in San Francisco talking about you telling another story. But what this is, the striptease artist really wasn't about clothes off. It was really about production of movement. Like, it could take an hour for a glove to come off. It was a story that was being told about sensuality, about passion, about, you know, breath of time. And it was just, and that's the part of it that I'm exploring. And then, of course, in her case, her movements, there are people coming through her body, which, whether the people in front of her is in this story, not just necessarily the audience Friday and Saturday night, but in the time in which this was happening to her in 1933, what the audience did not know, they literally couldn't see the people come through her, but their essence, their spirit, and that's what was evoking in them feelings of emotional intensity, not sexual, but they would feel things, and that's why they came to see her, because they was like, something happened to me as a human being that I went there maybe because I wanted to see something sexual, but they leave when they see her perform. Her name is Stardust, and they leave and with a bigger heart. There's a sadness they feel about humanity or greatness they feel about humanity. So it's a different kind of story that she tells, that the universe has brought her to this unlikely place to support people in filling their humanity.
Yeah. But it's interesting that this character, she's trained as a physician, and physicians are healers. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation about this woman's hands, and also I think you said that she was a dark complexion woman, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and her husband was not dark, and so she had these self-image issues because around beauty that she was also working through. So it's not a stretch to believe that as a stripper, because striptease is an art. I mean, you look at, what's that famous movie? Gypsy Rose Lee, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and then this woman's name is Stardust. I mean, think about the song. Like, it has lyrics. Read the song. Listen to the song. Do you play the song at all as a part of the soundtrack of the piece that her name calls?
No, what we've done with this, with the music, is we have tried to create, I think there's maybe one song in there that would be familiar to the audience, but for the most part, we try to create the music up out of the emotions of the story at that particular time. Mm-hmm. So, no, but you know, I'm going to have to go back and listen to that song, actually. Stardust.
Yes, I was just like, what are the lyrics? It has lyrics. I'm like, are the lyrics, you know, do they call into being her person? the name, and you know, like, because that's kind of cool when there's that double entendre kind of thing happening with regards to you know, you got the name, you got Stardust, and when I see here Stardust, I think of the lyrics and the tune because it's famous. And then for a woman to have a name, you know, Stardust, like, wow, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Frank Sinatra sang Stardust. Nat King Cole sang Stardust. Hoagy Carmichael sang. Yeah, I think Hoagy Carmichael wrote Stardust. Yeah, I'm just looking it all up because I have a computer here.
Wow, that is so
and
fantastic.
As I ask you this question, because when you said Stardust, I'm like, whoa, that's a song. That's so cool
and
to have a woman who's a stripper
really even
who has a song.
That, but the thing, right, when she got her name that night when she, right after the last gathering she has with this group of people, her peers that she's been, you know, pulled away from. And she leaves there, and she takes an old man, finds her, and he calls her. He says, "You are my Stardust tonight."
Mm. Wow. And, you know, I'm looking at this, and it is so fits this woman, the lyrics. Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new and each kiss an inspiration, ah, but that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song.
Oh my
God. Beside the garden wall, when stars are bright, you are in my arms. The nightingale tells his fairy tale, a paradise where roses grow. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it will remain, my stardust melody, the memories of love's refrain. Like, wow, girl, works so well.
Wow. I'm having
Hoagy
such
Carmichael, man, that's awesome.
It is, and I just clicked it put it in my computer, and Carmack McRae came up. She's at a piano.
Carmack McRae, oh, my gosh, she's
good,
too?
Yes.
Ooh.
Yes. Yes. So definitely I might listen to it after we talk, because she's just the picture of her. On this YouTube video, it's like, oh, my gosh, she has this beautiful black dress on off one of the shoulders. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. I had not thought about that piece. I just, in terms of writing it, and this man who, you know, name says to her, "You are my star," does for him in 1933. It's the greatest thing. He migrated from some place in the South, and he picks her up one night when she's totally almost in a state of, I guess if one would see her today, you would know that she probably needs to go to the hospital. I mean, that's the kind of state that she's in. She's just blown away by the pain of the full evening, and he says, "Get in the car, I'll take you where you need to go." And what she says is, "I have no place to go." And he says to her what his mama used to always say to him. So we have to really think about the time frame. It's 1933. He's about 70 years old. And he says his mama said to him, you will always have somewhere to go. You just may not be wanted.
Oh, interesting.
And so, so for him, that meant he took that, you know, so our parents or someone who's raising us tell us these things, we wonder all our life, what did that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
And what his mama was trying to say to him is that you go, because remember, it's segregation. You go. You may not be wanted, but you have a right to go where you want to go. You just may not be wanted. So he says it to her, passes it on to her in that moment, and he says to her, "You are my stardust."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know former congressman, former mayor, freedom fighter Ron Dellums, he said at an event I went to that was looking at Martin King's legacy, that just like what this character's mother told him, people might not want you to belong, but you have a right to be at that table.
That's right.
So you go claim your seat.
That's right.
Because the seat is empty. The seat is empty. It's just sitting there at the table and it's empty because so many people are saying, "No, you shouldn't be in the room." But that's your seat. That's our seat. you know. Mm-hmm. And so, no, you go claim your seat at the table, and you, you know, it's the discourse is yours too. You know, this democracy is not something that's just for one group of people. This nation's like, oh, heck no. We're all Americans.
Yes. And that's what his mama said to him. You always have some place to go. You just may not be wanted when you get there, but you have a right to get there and to go. And
right.
Says,
it's like, yeah, and it's like,
you
don't
always
have to like me. That's all right, because you don't, you know, it's not your country anyway. It's our country.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Wow. It's been so wonderful speaking to you. And I wanted to ask you before you, you know, get on to preparations, because the weekend is just the day after tomorrow. And you're having your first show, you know, Friday. I wanted to ask you about the research, because I know for all of your work, what really makes it, you know, so powerful is the background stuff that goes into it. Like, you know, when you're doing your research and giving your character, who is, you know, you created this person, this character.
Mm-hmm.
However, this character resonates because this character is grounded in some real lives.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you could talk about some of the, you know, sort of that burlesque genre, and, you know, during the Harlem Renaissance, and these characters that, these people that you found to that would be colleagues of
mm-hmm.
your character.
Mm-hmm. Well, the process for this show, and as in most shows that I create, the character comes to me first. They come to me first. So I was having lunch with a friend, and the whole hand thing happened. So let me say this in a way that makes sense to your listening audience. So I'm sitting there talking, and I'm moving my hands, and suddenly I'm fascinated by everyone's hands, and I'm like, okay. So then I begin to listen to myself. I've learned in my life, once I realized that I was born a storyteller, I began to listen and to breathe, and then I realized there was a character who was saying, pay attention. So I know this sounds kind of like, oh, but that's the truth of how I began. And then once I realized, oh, this is a striptease artist, and she's trying to say that her movements have meaning. They have meaning, and those meanings, it takes us on a journey into other people's lives. So then I just started, you know, internet Googling striptease artists, black striptease artists, started looking at the time period that she was in, the 1930s, and looking at some of the issues that we were faced in America then. And so we definitely knew there wasn't a lot of women in the medical field. I knew that there had been a huge tumble in her life. I mean, these things were happening in my dream world and in my daydream world, so both sleep and daydream world. So I knew that I'm looking up women, Negro, female Negro doctors, medicine, and started to get that research when the first medical schools for women in the country, and how many black doctors left this country, be trained and come back. And then I started looking at I realized how dark she was, so I thought, oh my God, this had to be incredibly challenging for her. And then somehow there was a truer story that came up in this, because this research, formal or informal research, began happening like 9 months ago about this show, that a true story came up, like we find things when we least expect them, that became in my own family of a woman who was dark that married a man who was very light, and how that tore her up mentally, not between him and her, but his family, her friends, and what that did to her life and to their relationship.
Mm.
So what started off as an act of love, how that ended up over time, and how it was said that she lost her mind, that she lost her mind. So I kind of included that inside of it as well, in terms of doing that research on how did she feel being dark. So she had the whole gender role, being a professional woman and being a dark woman. So she had it coming from all sides.
Wow.
So that was my process.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a really fantastic show, as all of your shows are. They're all really unique and different, but then there's like a through line, it seems.
Yes.
You know, for the work, because, you know, you're interested in certain things, and and the way you put your, you know, just like your, the way you present, it's like, yeah, that has a Javelin Richards mark on it, like so like a blink.
Yeah.
Kind of things. Like, yeah, this is, you know, we could see it as like you have like a certain style that
I call
your
it
work.
The nappy headed love stories. They're nappy headed love stories.
Yeah.
They're nappy headed love, and a part of it too, I think it's what I ask of myself. Again, the stories come to me. Well, so why do they come to me? I think it's because I have given myself permission spiritually. Mm-hmm. I've given myself permission to feel and to be open.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that once our hearts are open in some level, and again, I know this sounds sort of foo-foo Berkeley-ish, like I'm meditating on some rock somewhere, but the truth of it is that I think once the universe knew that I was open and I, you know, you're born a certain way, a gift is given, and you accept that gift, you open yourself to that, and then because I am born a woman, I am born a woman of color, I am born in this time in our history where we're struggling with these challenges, whatever they may be, that those challenges need to be dealt with, rectified, looked at, discarded, so then that for me as a writer, those are the topics that seem to come in me, and I'm opening, and so the characters come and say, okay, I trust you, now I'm going to tell you my story, and then you put it out there, and we'll see what happens.
Right, yeah.
I hope that made sense.
Oh, totally, it definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for the work that you bring to us, because it's always just really a fantastic journey. And I just love your characters, all of them that I've met. I have met them all, but I've enjoyed everyone I've met.
Thank you, Wanda. You're wonderful. Thank you for supporting my art. I mean, that's one of the most incredible things in the world, when there are people there, because there is that solitude in the work that we do, all of us, not just writers, but all of us. There's that solitude that we deeply love. But it's nice with other people when you're putting your work out there, whatever that may be, whatever, if it's baking a pie, whatever that may be, to have people to call out and say, here, I'm here. I want to hear your story. I want to see what you're doing. And you do that, and I really appreciate that, and thank you deeply.
Oh, you're welcome.
When I see you out there in the world at some art event, and I just see you in the world, I mean, you clearly are a person who's invested in humanity and invested in moving humanity forward. And that's like, wow, okay. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. And again, we're speaking to Javelin Richards about her latest work, and it's going to be a part of the Garages Raw Resident Artist Workshop series, and it's called Stripping Down to Story, and it's written and performed by Javelin Richards, and it's, again, this weekend, Friday and Saturday, so you don't want to miss it, 715 Bryant Street at 5th Street in San Francisco, 8 o'clock both nights, July 13th and 14th. You know, turn that thing around. It's going to be Friday, your lucky day. July 13th. So if you have, like, any kind of superstition and you need to, like, turn it around, then you should go Friday and Saturday. So Friday and know that it's all good, and go Saturday because you can testify to it, okay?
I like that. Good for you. That's beautiful. I hope to see folks there.
Yeah, and the phone number for the garage, so you can find out where they're located, since I'm not sure if I'm telling you right about the Civic Center getting off there, so don't take my word for that. It might be Montgomery. It might be Embarcadero. I'm not sure. So you should call.
Beautiful.
The phone number is 415-518-1517, 415-518-1517. Javelin, do you have a website yet?
No, we're working on it. I do have a website, but it's under construction now. It's just on the phone this morning. So,
okay.
So I will figure that out.
Sure. And the garage has a website. It's 975howard.com. 975howard.com. So that's their website for more information. So you can check them out there as well. And again, it's only, what, $10 to $20?
Yes, yeah, slide and scale. Yeah, do what you can.
Yeah, you can do that. And there are only, what, 60 seats or 80 seats?
It's 60.
60. So, you know, like, you need to, like, get there on time because you might not be able to squeeze into the space. Sounds really
right. And you get it on brown paper. I think it's on the website, the garage website, where you can go click on and buy your tickets. I can't even say early because we're in the 11th hour of the show. So definitely buy your tickets online.
Yeah.
Make sure you have a seat.
Right, definitely.
Perfect.
All right, cool. Well, thank you again so much, and good luck on the opening of the show. I think I'm going to probably come on Saturday night.
Okay.
Yeah, but definitely I want to catch her, this woman. She sounds really fantastic. Yeah,
okay.
Diane Edwards, she sounds like a woman I want to know.
Yay. She'll be there. She'll be there Friday and Saturday.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Wanda.
You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Peace and blessings. So we're going to play a song by Ruthie Foster, who is actually going to be in town as well. Tomorrow, Thursday, she'll be in Oakland at Yoshi's. And she is a fantastic woman. And I think we're going to play this song for Javelin's character, Diane Edwards. It's called Truth. And then I have an interview with Ruthie Foster, but I'm not certain if we're going to get to it in time during the broadcast portion. You might have to go into the archives to listen to the rest of it, because this archived interview that I'm going to play starts with Mavis Staples. And then I'm not certain if Ruthie Foster follows that or not. I'll let you know that after we finish playing Truth. And again, we're sending this out to Diane Edwards, who is the protagonist in Javelin Richards Stripping Down to Story. Yeah, that was Ruthie Foster Truth. I think she is our second interview. So first part is Miss Mavis Staples. And this interview was recorded in June of 2009. So it's been a minute since we spoke to Ruthie Foster. But couldn't get in touch with her to have a more recent interview, but she's just really fantastic, wonderful, wonderful musician and composer, and as you know, this on Truth, and I'm sure she might have some other CDs out by now, but I happen to like The Truth According to Ruthie Foster, and that's the title track. I think it's really fantastic, and so we are going to play this interview with her in a sec, and then, yeah, there's a whole lot of great stuff happening. I thought I was going to play an interview with James T. Lane from the Scottsboro Boys, but that didn't happen because I wasn't able to get the interview uploaded in the studio because I'm broadcasting from the College of Alameda this afternoon. I wasn't able to get back to my home studio. Things like that happen. So, yeah, so we're shifting into another gear, and I think it's working out well. Mama Staples is just fantastic, and we're so happy that she is around, and because not many of her generation are still with us. And so it's really great that she's here, and she comes to the Bay Area often. She was here in January as a part of the Martin King celebration. I was still in South Africa, so I ended up missing that, but I'm sure it was fantastic. So here is Ruthie Foster. She's going to follow, again, Mavis Staples, and this is from June 23rd, 2009. Enjoy.
Hideout, it was going to be trouble. All right. Yes, I'm home. There you go, baby sister. I'm showing up home. We're going to sing for you now the very first song that Pops taught us. Yes. He used to sing with an all-male group, you know. Six guys. The Trumpet Jubilee. And Pops would go to rehearsal. He'd come home disgusted because these guys wouldn't come to rehearsal. So this last time he came home and he headed straight to the closet. He had a little guitar that he bought at the pawn shop. Yeah. Called us children into the living room and set us on the floor in a circle. My sister Cleo, brother Purvis, sister Yvonne, and moi.
All right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So he began to give us voices to sing that he and his brothers and sisters used to sing down in Mississippi. So, you know, there were 14 of them. Yeah, I said the same thing. I said the same thing. They had a choir. But it was so many of them that they ran out of names. They got down to my uncle, they named him Sears. And they named Pops Roebuck. You didn't know that, did you? Yeah. Yeah, so Pops, this is the very first song he taught us. My Aunt Katie lived with us. And she came through one night. She said, "Shucks, y'all sound pretty good. I believe I want y'all to sing at my church." We went to Aunt Katie's church, and we sang this song. People liked it so much, they clapped us back three times. And yeah, three times we had to sing the same song. It was the only one that Pops had taught us all the way through, you know. So So it took a few years. But after we sang that song at Aunt Katie's church, we went back home and Pop said, shucks, these people like us. We're going home and write some more songs. And the rest is history.
That's Mavis Staples, and that's one of the encores on her latest album, Live at the Hideout, and was actually taped June 23rd, 2008, in Chicago, and was released on November 4th, the day that President Obama had his victory. You're listening to Wanda's Picks coming to you live from Austin, Texas. Yes, we are recording here live. And so what I'm going to do is I'm not going to make you wait to the end of the show. I am going to play the song and then introduce Ms. Staples, who's going to be in town this at the end of this week, Sunday, June 28th. I'll tell you more about that later. So anyway, here is Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
I was standing by my window. It was on a cold and cloudy day when I saw the hoods come rolling, oh, to carry my mother away. Will the circle be unbroken? By and by, Lord, by and by, there's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. Oh, I told the undertaker, undertaker, please drive slow. Cause this lady that you are holding, Lord, I hate to see her go.
Yeah.
Well, that was from Live at the Hideout, Miss Mavis Staples singing in Chicago, and the release just came out in November, so it is sort of hot off the presses. And she's going to be in California at the Kate Wolf Memorial Festival in Laytonville, California, on Sunday. She's closing out the festival Sunday, June 28th, but the festival actually begins Friday, June 26th. And on the bill for June 26th is another one of my guests today, and that's Ruthie Foster, who's got a new album, The Truth According to Ruthie Foster, and I'm in her town, and she's in my town. So it's kind of funny. I'm in Austin, and she's in California. She's going to be in California. So you all have to tell me all about that great concert. She's going on about 8:10, and the I think the Preservation Hall band is also on this bill. And that weekend, the Blind Boys are also going to be performing, along with some other really, really hot groups. Mavis Staples was born July 10th, 1939, in Chicago, Illinois, and she's an American rhythm, blues, and gospel singer and civil rights activist who recorded with her family's band, the Staples Singers. Yeah, I hadn't known about the civil rights activism part of her career. And also didn't know that she had a summer birthday, so happy birthday in advance. And we, I had her on my show last week. Actually, no, I recorded this interview last week, but we weren't able to record it, to broadcast it. So I know you've been anticipating this conversation. Really, really, really nice and real special. So here's Mavis Staples talking about her father and her siblings and sort of what happened with regards to their involvement in the movement, as she calls it. So here's Ms. Staples. It was recorded June 17th.
That I was actually going to be honored with an interview. And we've been going back and forth for like, well, actually not going back and forth. I put the request in a month ago, and I just found out at 7 o'clock
that
I had interest. Like, oh, my God. It's like, it's been a while since I've seen you out here in California. The last time I saw you was at the Great American Music Hall.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no, we've been there many times since that.
Oh, yeah, I know, but that was my last time seeing you.
Oh, okay.
I got a chance to come backstage and say hi to you and meet your sister, Yvonne.
Mm-hmm.
It was just really lovely, really,
thank
really
you.
Lovely. And I haven't had a chance, like I said, since I didn't know I was going to have this interview, to actually get a copy of the Hideout, your Hope at the Hideout. Yeah, that was recorded. It's been almost a year now, huh?
Well, actually, it was, in November. It was the day before the election, November 3rd, that it was released. That we recorded it last year in June.
Right.
It was released right on election day.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah, November. So it's not quite a year old yet.
Okay.
But Matt, they should have sent you a CD.
Yeah, no, he didn't send me anything.
He should have sent you one when you first asked for the interview.
Yeah.
That's terrible. I'll let him know, though.
Okay, thank you.
Send you one.
Okay, but I was just, just sort of looking at, the breadth of your career and it being, this particular conversation, being the week of Juneteenth, and we actually poured libations for the ancestors and the international libation at the same time this past Saturday, the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, one of the participants, he said that all the teens, we claim them all, so like the 13th through the 19th,
right,
they're all Freedom
right.
Days. I'm like, oh, that's yeah, and I just wanted to ask you, I hadn't realized until I was doing some research this morning, your involvement and sort of how the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in particular and Papa Staples, believing in his cause and saying, that he, really loved Dr. King, that sort of, took you all into the Civil Rights Movement. I wonder if you could talk about some of the parallels between your activity, as culture workers in the Civil Rights Movement and your activity now as a culture worker in sort of the new movement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we, you know, we began singing strictly gospel when we first started singing back in late 1949, 1950.
Right.
And we happened to be in Montgomery on a Sunday. We didn't have to sing until that night. And Pops wanted to go down to Dr. King's church. He told us that this man, Martin Luther King, is here, and he'd been hearing him on the radio, and he wanted to go to his church. So we all went down to Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and we were ushered in, seated, and someone let Dr. King know that we were in the service, and he acknowledged us and said he was happy to have Pop Staples and his daughters in the service this morning, and we hope you enjoy the service. Well, after, Dr. King was standing at the door to shake Worshipper's hand, and the Pops stood there and talked to him for a while. Later on that day, we get back to the hotel, Pops called us to his room again and told us he really liked this man's message. He said, I like his message, and I think that if he can preach it, we can sing it. So we began writing freedom songs. We joined the movement. And sang. We would sing before Dr. King would speak. Our first song that we wrote was March Up Freedom's Highway, and that was for the march from Selma to Montgomery. Then It's a Long Walk to D.C., but I Got My Walking Shoes On. That was for the march to Washington. And Pops, we saw nine black children trying to board a school bus in Little Rock, Arkansas, back in 1959, I believe it was. And when they finally, you know, we saw them being so abused. Pops, we watched the news, and he just said to himself, now, why are they treating them so bad? Why are they treating them like that? And he wrote that song that evening, which this song turned out to be Dr. King's favorite. As time went on, you know, we would march and sing when we could be with everyone. But sometimes we would be working. But that was a time for me that just made me feel like we were doing something that we were supposed to be doing. You know, to me, we were still singing gospel because we were singing truth. It just, from the time we started going in the South singing, my father had let us know what to expect when we were in the South. And, you know, he just conditioned us for going. But then as we started singing these songs, it felt like to me, well, we're singing, we've been abused down here. We've been to jail. We've been ran off the road, off the highway, and we've been to where we couldn't drink off the water fountain or go into a bathroom unless we went into color. We couldn't stay in hotels. So to be singing these songs to me and to all of us was like we were planning something new. We were helping to get to another place in our life, to a better place, you know, where we could be accepted. And in these later years, I felt the same way. I felt, you know, Pops used to tell the writers, songwriters, if you want to write for the Staple Singers, read the headline. We wanted to sing about what was happening in the world today and to try to sing a song to try to fix it. So when I recorded my CD, We'll Never Turn Back, with Rykuda, that's what I was doing, reading the headlines, and it's still here. The racism and the whole bit from the 60s, I saw Katrina. I saw, well, I'm reading the headlines. I'm still seeing that a white policeman shot down a young black man 50 rounds mm-hmm. on his way to his wedding. And right here in Chicago, I can see on the news a black family might move into a white neighborhood, and they get in just fine. They get moved in, mm-hmm. but overnight, when they get up in the morning, there's graffiti on their garage with the N-word, get out. There's cross in the yard. Their car is sprayed with graffiti. You know, so it's still here. It's still it was still time. It was a time for me, I'd say, to sing those songs again.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do it in 70, in 07.
Right, yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's just me singing my life around in a full circle and come back to these songs that so that this generation, these young people today can hear these songs and know what they're about and know that what we went through, mm-hmm. you know, to get them to where they can be today. And they need to know this is history, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was proud to have lived in a time where I just looked and saw history being made. You know, I stood by Dr. Martin Luther King, shook his hand, mm-hmm. would speak to him. He would never talk to us girls. He would always talk to Pop, but he would just say, "How are you doing, girls?" "All right, yes, sir." But he and Pop got really close.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where I am today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've made the CD, "We'll Never Turn Back," and then a live CD singing the songs. So people be saying, "Well, Mavis, what are you going?" You know, I feel now it's time to move on. I won't stop singing those songs, but I'd like to sing now about a brighter day ahead. You know, something happy, some happy, still uplifting spiritual songs. But you know, just with our new president,
mm-hmm.
You know, we that's one thing that I never thought I would live to see, and it was just overwhelming. You know, when this young man to be president of the United States. You know, so I feel with that happening, we have moved a little closer.
Mm-hmm.
We moved a lot closer, you know. But you still, the songs are still needed. I believe these songs will be needed for long after I'm going on to glory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I just cannot see the people. It's not all white. Some, you know, some are going to hold on. You see how all these hate crimes are cropping up, and all of these Ku Klux Klan are suiting up again. You know, so it's going to always be some that, you know, don't want to have harmony,
mm-hmm.
and live together in this world. You know, so this is where are you in Laytonville?
No, I'm in Oakland, California.
Oh, you're in Oakland?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I knew we were going to Layton.
Right, yeah, you're Layton is not far away. It's,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, it's. I think it's about 2 or 3 hours away from me, from where I am presently.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, it's easy. Yeah. Well, yeah, I was just thinking, as you were talking about, you know, Chicago's, you know, history with regards to, you know, having Lorraine Hansberry there, you know, and her history with her father as a broker, moving the family into neighborhoods where, you know, African Americans weren't desired, and you know, and sort of the terrorism that faced her family, you know, the scary terrorism and the
and her play, you know, Raisin in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I was thinking about Emmett Till and his mother, and, you know, Emmett Till was from Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We lived through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
We're a young man, you know, in a, right from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we honor Emmett Till every year.
Oh.
And his mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the, we have a Emmett Till Boulevard, you know, and there's a memorial for him every year. And we knew his mother. We never didn't get a chance to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
But his mother worked close with, in the churches, and, you know, she did a lot of good things before she passed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a lot of come out of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Chicago, Dr. King said Chicago was the worst place
mm-hmm.
that he had visited. When he was marching, he said Chicago, you know, the people were just so rude. So but he had an uprising. You know, he came to Chicago and stayed a few days and marched.
Mm-hmm.
Stones were thrown at Dr. King, and
yeah.
you know he felt some really really evil bad feelings about Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we have a history of and you know you remember what you I don't know how old you are, but 16 I think it was 69 when they had the big riot after the. That was 68. How the police were beating people down because
yeah.
they were marching.
Mm-hmm.
They were Dr. King had been assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just where we are now. That's where you know we, Staple Singers. We've always wanted to sing songs with a positive message. And I still say that I am a gospel singer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm that's home for me. You know,
mm-hmm.
so and mostly anything I sing, a house is not a home.
Mm-hmm.
The, you're gonna hear some gospel in my voice, I think, because
mm-hmm.
the when I recorded a house is not a home, the gospel disc jockeys picked it up and played it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's one really wonderful thing about, you know, about your work and the Staple Singers is, you know, I guess you were one of the first ensembles that one could say had audiences from a variety of different types of tastes. I mean, you know, you have people that, you know, were strictly gospel, and you have people
mm-hmm.
that were more R&B. And, I mean, now, you know, you've got audiences in the hip-hop community, the folk community.
Right.
I mean, you know, anyone, like you were saying, I really liked when you said that you're singing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that it's open.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever, you know, and Pops finally started telling people, you know, we're not categorized in our music
mm-hmm.
because it's some of everything, some of all types in our music, the sound, the folk. We all of a sudden, we were doing folk festivals,
mm-hmm.
jazz festivals. We've had Cannonball Adderley and some other jazz artists to record our songs. In fact, Cannonball did Why Am I Treated So Bad?
Mm.
He thought that was great, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a live CD that he's playing that on, and he talked about Papa Staples, and he wrote this song, and boy, Pops was just smiling. And so my father was really, really a great man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Pops. So he just took us on his wing. My mother, he wanted the kids with him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother just let him go.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a hands-on father, you know. He would take us to the movies on Saturdays and take us to Sunday school on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd make us popcorn balls and make us homemade candy.
Mm-hmm.
peanut brittle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a father. And back then, you know, the ladies in the church, they would just go all over. Here's a father with his children. You just don't see that. And here's the father. You know, and that made us proud, made Pop proud. Because we were with our father, and it got so, we hung with our father so much, people started asking, is your mother alive?
Mm-hmm.
We said, yeah, our mother's home. My mother, she's our spiritual, she was the wheel in the middle of a wheel.
Mm-hmm.
She kept everything going. If we had a little argument, mama would, she'd know just how to get it better. And and she was the world's greatest cook.
Mm-hmm.
She was just the best.
Mm-hmm.
She would make sweet potato pies, and you could taste the butter. She'd put coconut in them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And my father started taking mama's sweet potato pies to this jockey, and so it got so people started saying, well, paper singers don't need no payola because they have pieola. And the people, they would play our songs because mama was giving them sweet potato. My daddy said, well, that's all right, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing because, you know, when you see films like the recent one, I think it was called Cadillac, and it's talking about the music industry and how it wasn't, you know, talent or having a good piece, a good quality work wasn't necessarily what meant that you would get played.
Right.
It meant that who you knew in the studio and whether or not you made it worth their while.
That's right.
Yeah, I wonder.
That's the truth.
Yeah, has it changed any?
Oh, well, you know, I just can't say because we stopped really being in the swing of the record labels.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when disco came in, that people didn't want to hear any good music anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then rap came.
Mm-hmm.
And all during this time, the record companies, like, they're supposed to be like only one record company now because they all merged.
Yeah.
And then the disc jockeys, you can't just go in anymore to see them. The doors are locked.
Mm-hmm.
You usually could just walk in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And go on the radio, talk to the disc jockeys. But you had need an appointment now, so I'm not in that loop where I would know if anybody is paying the disc jockeys, it's the record company.
Okay.
But I don't think they're really into that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think that payola, because that was illegal. And somebody went to jail back then. Got in big trouble for payola. So I just don't hear about it anymore. You know, we're on a different train now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the women artists that you really admired. I remember we had a conversation, you were talking about how you really love Mahalia Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk about her and about Odetta. And also if you could talk about Ruth Brown, if you had any relationship with her.
Okay. All right. Now, this is going to be my last
sure.
question.
Okay.
Yeah, now, my sister Mahalia Jackson was my idol.
Mm-hmm.
She was the very first female voice that I heard on the record. And when I was about 8 years old, 7 or 8, my father would play these big 78 records, you know. excuse me. And he would always play males, the quartet, like the Soul Stirrers, the Fairfield Four, the Blind Boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would just always hear those men singing. And one day I was back in my little play area, and I heard this lady's voice. And it just moved me on up into the living room where Pops was. And I sit on the floor. When it finished, I said, "Who was that, Daddy?" He said, "May, it was that Sister Mahalia Jackson." And he could tell I liked it. He said, "You like it, don't you?" I said, "Yes, sir, I like it." And then Pops had to play Sister Mahalia Jackson for me just about every day. And one day he came in. He said, "Mavis, guess what? Well, now, I'm about 11 years old now." And I said, "What, Daddy?" He said, "They want us to open up for Sister Mahalia Jackson down at Tabernacle Baptist Church on Monday." Mm-hmm. And Lord, my little heart just felt like it was coming out of my chest. I got so excited. This was the first chance I had to meet her. I remember so well what she said to me, how she looked. When she came in the door, she looked like a giant princess to me. Because she was already dressed. She had on her, an ivory-colored brocade gown. And so I ran over to her. My father had told my mother, because all that weekend that I was talking, see, Pops told me this on a Friday. And I had to wait until Monday night. I had to wait the whole weekend. So I would be walking around the house talking about what I'm going to say to her and how I couldn't wait to see. I was singing a song. And my mother told me, she said, "Mavis, baby, don't get on her nerves here." I said, "Mama, I'm not going to get on her nerves." And so they had my sisters watching me. It turned out that we were dressing in the same dressing room with Sister Mae Jackson. And Yvonne and Cleetie were watching me, but I was watching the door. And when she came in, I ran over, and I told her, I said, "Hello, Sister. Hello, Mrs. Sister Mahalia Jackson." Because I thought Sister was her first name. Because Pops would always say, "Sister Mahalia Jackson." So she laughed. She got tickled the way I said it. And she said, "Well, how are you, baby?" And I said, "Oh, I'm fine. My name is Mavis. And I sing with my family. I sing with my father, my brother, my sister." She said, "Oh, well, I want to hear you sing." So when we came back out from singing, she told me, "You're a good little old singer." And then she gave me some advice on how to keep my voice and how to come out, how to go out after singing. Mm-hmm. You know, to always dry my skin and wait before I go out in the air. And we worked with Sister Mahalia Jackson many, many times after that. Mm-hmm. It came to her, she and my mother, she would come to our house on the 4th of July for barbecue. Mm-hmm. And so she was just the greatest. There will never be another Sister Mahalia Jackson. And Odetta, the same. Odetta was just the most beautiful voice, you know, that she would take you back. You know, she would take you back to the times when you would, it just seemed like, for me, I used to stay down south with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid. And Odetta reminded me of the sounds that I heard down in Mississippi, in the little wooden church up on the hill, you know, where there was nothing but patting your feet and clapping your hands, no piano, no organs, you know, and just the sound of those voices in that little church, you know, and that wooden, that's a sound I'll never forget. And when I would hear Odetta sing, "I'm on my way to freedom land," you know, and she, her voice was just strong, you know, and she, and her, Odetta herself was just a beautiful, beautiful spirit. She was just so beautiful. And the last time I saw her, last time I saw Sister Mahalia Jackson, mm-hmm. was in 1969, when we were doing a gospel festival, and I had the best feeling of my career. I had to sing with her. Mm-hmm. She would lean over, she said, "Baby, Haley, don't feel too good, and I need you to help me sing this song." Mm-hmm. Odetta, the last time I saw her, was we did an all female. They called it the Lady of the Blues, but Ladies of the Blues. It was five of us, I think. Irma Thomas, myself, Odetta, and someone else was, I think, a little young guitarist. That was at Morgan Freeman's club in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And they filmed it. That I can't think of the year, but it was in the 90s, I think, like 1999, maybe 2000. But that was the last time I saw Odetta.
Mm.
And Ruth Brown was just a buddy.
Okay.
We were partners. We were like what you call partners in crime. She could talk. We would gossip. You know, we would have big fun. Big fun. And I met Ruth Brown way back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine knew her. And she was at a club downtown Chicago. And I went with him to see her. And from that day on, that night on, We just stayed friends and had each other's phone number. We called each other, and we worked together quite a bit.
Yeah.
But she was something else. She could really talk. I know I can talk, but I met my match when I ran into Brown. I'd have to stop and listen because she would be telling such good stories and talking so good, you know. And I miss Bruce. I miss Odetta. I'm trying to think. The last time I saw Ruth, it was at New York Radio Hall, Radio City Music Hall in New York.
Uh-huh.
We did Odetta was there too. Odetta came to our room and said she wanted to dress. I want to be with my sister. And she dressed in my dressing room, because that was a affair that the little director Martin Scorsese.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did this. That's a DVD too.
You mean the Lightning in the Bottle one?
Lightning in the Bottle.
Okay.
Right. And that was the last time that I saw Ruth. In fact, we went to that thing together. We were staying in the same hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruth. She was carrying on. She's a big clown. You know, she's a really, all of those ladies,
mm-hmm.
I tell you, I'm so grateful to be fortunate enough to meet them,
mm-hmm.
to be in their presence.
Right.
They
yeah.
were great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just wanted to mention that Gwendolyn Brooks is also a Chicagoan, and she's a...
She is.
Yeah. And
boy.
Yeah, and her birthday is this month.
Is that right?
Yeah, she's Gemini, like me.
All
yeah,
right, then.
Yeah, a lot of...
some good Geminis. Is Gladys nice as Gemini?
Oh, right, I know that. Okay.
Yeah, Prince's birthday was June 7th.
Okay.
And, there's a bunch of y'all. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
But Gemini are good people. Creative, because you got so many working for you. You got your twins, and then both of them, you got another set.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's some great, great people in Gemini.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you so much for the interview, and perhaps, you know, at some other time we might be able to talk, later on, you know, when, you know, you talked about how you're going to be singing other songs. So let me
okay.
nice to talk to you about
okay,
that.
Okay, that would be good.
Yeah, I want to tell
right.
you that your website is really
yeah, I have,
nice.
I could go on and on, but someone else is supposed to call me.
Right. Okay, well, yeah, I want to let you go. But I also want to ask you, just for future reference, I asked Matt, and he told me that because actually I have a radio show, and I had requested that I could record our interview for broadcast, and he told me that I couldn't. And I was wondering, do you do radio interviews?
Sure, I do.
Oh, okay, because I was wondering what the problem was. Okay.
He told you you couldn't?
Yeah, that I couldn't record you for a later broadcast. It's internet radio, but it's live, so I didn't understand. So anyway, I just was wondering about that.
Oh, okay. Okay, Mom.
Yes, it's UPS. Okay, you can send it up.
Now I got to go to the elevator.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
UPS. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't understand that either, because I do interviews right on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
If the person is on the radio,
yeah.
You know, if you wanted to record it and use it on your show,
mm-hmm.
You know, I don't understand that either.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you can.
Oh. Okay. All right, cool.
Okay, Wanda.
Thank you so much. All right, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, you heard it from Ms. Staples, and that's why you're hearing it now. She said I could. So that was Mavis Staples, and I didn't believe it that, gosh, she's been recording for 52 years now. It's so amazing. And I want to let you know again that she's going to be in California at the Kate Wolf Memorial Festival in Laythamville, and she's going to be closing it out on Sunday, June 28th. And I want to mention that her Mavis Staples Live Hope at the Hideout, yeah, the 14 tracks are For What It's Worth, Eyes on the Prize, which is really nice. Down in Mississippi, Wade in the Water, Waiting for My Child, This Little Light, Why Am I Treated So Bad, Freedom Highway, We Shall Not Be Moved, Circles, which is what I played at the beginning, start of the hour, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, the encore, On My Way, another encore, which is nice, and I'll Take You There, one of the Staples singers. And so what I'm going to close with on this interview, and then I'm going to roll right into Ruthie Foster. I think I'll play, I'm going to play Have a Little Faith, the title track of the CD by that title, and then I'm going to roll right into Ruthie Foster, and I might play, you know, I really, really like her title track, Truth According To, but I might play another one of hers, maybe Stone Love, I'm not sure yet. So as soon as I find it, I'm looking right now. I will play Have a Little Faith. Really, really, really nice. And then the next song I'm going to play a piece by Ruthie Foster from her latest. And again, she's going to be here. Ruthie Foster's band is going to be here on the Friday, June 26th. So that's also in Laythamville for the Kate Wolf Memorial Festival. And she's going to be going on at 8 o'clock, as I said before. So here's Mavis Staples, Have a Little Faith.
Little faith, my friend, we got to help each other through thick and thin. These are trying times that we're living in. Have a little faith, I say, have a little faith, my friend. We got trouble everywhere around the world. There's not a safe place to any woman, man, boy, or girl. And everywhere you turn, there's destruction and pain. You get a mouthful of promises and a hat full of rain. Just have a little faith, I say. Have a little faith, my friend. We got to help each other through thick and thin. These are trials. Got to
Have a little faith. And here's Ruthie Foster, Stone Love, from The Truth According To.
Oh,
the you sing it, just the title, The Truth According to Ruthie Foster, is so bold and courageous and inviting.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw you with Eric Bibb. I guess, was that this year at Yoshi's in San Francisco?
I do believe it was. It's been a you know, fast-paced year for me, so it's for me to keep up.
yeah, I didn't know you, but your name sounded like you were going to be great. So I came, and oh my goodness, because I really love Eric Bibb, and I noticed that he's on your The Truth According to Ruthie Foster. He's got a couple of his pieces. But you all are so phenomenal together, and I was sitting and I was thinking, oh man, I really want to get an interview with her. She tells such great stories, and she's so phenomenal on that guitar, and it's so pretty, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I've been been trying to see if I could connect with you. I think you were at Stanford at one of their Live in the Arts concerts this year also. And like you say, your tour schedule, you're just like all over the place, you know, like you're going to be in Layton on Friday. And I was wondering, do you know what time you're going to be performing at the concert there?
I think it's right before the main act. I think we're on about 8. So
mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure.
Okay.
Just looking at my itinerary
mm-hmm.
this morning, trying to figure out what time my flight actually takes off for that area.
Right, yeah.
But let's see. Yeah, I have 8:05 when we start.
Okay, yeah. So are you familiar with the Kate Wolf Festival?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I love that festival.
Mm-hmm.
Bring out the folkness in me.
Ah, okay.
The folkness.
Yeah, I was looking at, what's the name of the city you're from? I looked it up. Let's see, Gross, Texas?
Because
I had never heard of it. And so in reading different things about you, they say that, you know, you were born in Brazos Valley of Central Texas. And that you had a strong mother. And I guess you had a strong grandmother, too, the one that taught you how to project toward the door, sing toward the door.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I wonder if you could tell us sort of how you developed your voice and decided to make this your career.
Well, it's kind of it's an ongoing process, and it
mm-hmm.
started early with my grandmother, as you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
Big Mama.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
That's great you've got a Big Mama. It's really cool the folks that have Big Mamas.
I have a Big Mama. And, yeah, Big Mama would work with me on standing in front of people and speaking, you know, public speaking at church,
mm-hmm.
because that was our life, was work and school and play in church, and it was definitely one of those things that Big Mama wanted us to have a place
mm-hmm.
within the community and the family and in the church. And my strong suit, she recognized early that I was a really shy kid,
mm-hmm.
so she worked with me on public speaking, on how to, you know, I was working on my speech and trying not to stutter and fall all over myself. And my mother was a beautiful singer, and she insisted that I, after listening to me play the guitar for a couple of years and not sing, she burst in my room one day and basically said, "Now, you got to open your mouth and sing at some point." And so
mm-hmm.
she was a real influence on my starting to sing more in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, the gospel music and blues music was a huge part of my household, too. We listened to gospel music all the time, to Rosetta Tharpe, to, you know, even Blind Boys of Alabama, which I just got off the road with.
Yeah.
I grew up listening to the original Blind Boys recordings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 70s, it was Andre Crouch and Thunder Crouch. And, you know, I had a lot of cousins who were great singers. And real influential on my wanting to be able to sing. And blues was a huge part of what we listened to in the house. My dad was a big Lightnin' Hopkins, Muddy Waters, mm-hmm. than even Ike and Tina Turner. He and my mother would go out and see Ike and Tina Turner when they would tour through East Texas where I'm at. So a lot of soul music was a big influence on me growing up. Mm-hmm. And mostly just listening to music. I did a lot of listening in the early, early years. Not so much singing. I sang some, but it was really about listening and learning the different genres and really taking that away, taking the boundaries away from the genres and realizing that I just had a love for music, period, because I love show music and musicals, and I loved, rare records that people forget about, like Stevie Wonder, when he put out a record called Secret Life of Plants, that was all synthesized music. I loved that. It was something very different from anything I'd ever heard on the radio. So I grew up kind of a strange child when it came to mixing with my cousins and all. Because the more I got into music, the more I kind of pulled away from, playtime. Playtime for me was sitting and listening to records and just, getting into how something was produced and what did that sound come from and why is that lick there.
Mm-hmm.
It was about just really picking apart music in every way. And I eventually took the music lesson. My grandmother, Big Mama, and my mother had a lot to do with that, and they insisted I take piano.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, piano was my first instrument from about 11 years old on, and I eventually incorporated guitar because my dad got me a guitar after a lot of begging. He got me a guitar for Christmas when I was about 12.
Mm-hmm.
So I was learning both. I was learning guitar and piano at the same time. So that just put even more emphasis on my wanting to write.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I have all this background in gospel music and soul and blues and top 40, what was on the radio in the 70s, from Al Green to Andre Crouch, and learning how to want to write this music. And I just kind of took all of that and eventually ended up in school,
mm-hmm.
went to college, and studied music for 3 years in Waco at a community college there.
Mm-hmm.
A little program called it's a commercial music program. It's kind of like a little Berklee School of Music right here in the middle of Central Texas.
Nice.
That a lot of folks don't know about, but
mm-hmm.
should. And I got real hands-on experience with working with musicians and learning how to write and arrange and sightseeing and lots of ear training and even more intense piano training.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the skills I that really focused my musical instrument, which is voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it just basically brought me back to just one instrument and being a great vocal stylist. So I spent a lot of years working on my voice during that time. And I still run into a couple of instructors from here to, every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm on the road, I just ran into my old music director who's in Chicago right now, and I still go to him for advice on different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's his name?
His name is David Hibbard, H-I-B-B-A-R-D.
Huh.
Yeah, David Hibbard is basically started the commercial music program here in Texas, in Waco.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So you say here, so you still live in Texas?
I do. I live in Austin. I'm in Austin, here in the central part of the heart of Texas is what we call it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hot. It's about 88 degrees right now.
Oh, is it? Okay, I'm going to be in Austin tomorrow for a week.
Oh, bring some, bring clothes that are cool.
Bring some of the Pacific Ocean, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. So your The Truth According to Ruthie Foster is your sixth album, right?
Yeah, I guess it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was just, I really love, the stories that you tell here. You could say that, thematically it's about love,
because, you know, there's all different kinds of love, and the lyrics are just phenomenal. And your instrumentation, it's just really, really cool what you do with the guitar. I mean, you know, from like sort of real sort of like bluegrass kind of sounds, and, you know, to real quiet and mellow. So I was wondering if you could talk about sort of how you pulled this album together and who's on it with you. I was reading that you've got like some really, you know, phenomenal artists that are performing with you, and I was wondering, are, you know, who's going to be traveling with you, you know, from the album, and or do you have like another band, and this was a studio recording? How did you pull this together?
Well, the record came together mm-hmm. with the help of Chris Goldsmith, producer. Mm-hmm. We kind of stayed in touch with each other through email and MP3s,
mm-hmm.
and then music back and forth. As far as what we wanted, the kind of music, the kind of record we knew we wanted to do, but we started with one song at a time,
mm-hmm.
and of course starting off with songs that I had been sitting on and songs that I was writing at the time. Like Stone Love and
mm-hmm.
Truth actually was one of those songs that almost didn't make the record. I wrote it the day I was supposed to leave for Memphis to go record, and it still wasn't quite finished then, but Chris didn't know that. I just kind of made up words as I
mm-hmm.
while we were tracking, and they seemed to work out. But yeah, we have Robin Ford on guitar in the studio, and it was a real thrill to get a chance to get him to come out and record with us there in Memphis, because Robin's semi-retired, so he only comes out when he really wants to.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that meant, it really means a lot to me that he did that. Gosh, we've got Jim Dickinson on keys, who's worked with the Rolling Stones and Aretha Franklin. A lot of these phone calls,
mm-hmm.
well, all of them, Chris made.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess he's got a pretty big, important black book when it comes to
musicians.
Uh-huh. And I'm real, real grateful that he was able to get these guys to come out and play with us. We did it in Memphis because I wanted to have a soul sound
mm-hmm.
kind of extend on the phenomenal record that we put out before
mm-hmm.
And take that soul to Memphis. Because Memphis is a totally different feel as
mm-hmm.
far as soul music. You know, the Sax record, where that came out of, you know, that feel for music is just, it's just dripping soul. And it's just dripping barbecue, as far as I'm concerned. I love barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
So give me an excuse to be in Memphis and capture some of the, you know, some of that mystique about digging deep, you know, soul to the bone kind of feel. And we recorded during Isaac Hayes' passed. It's a little bit before that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
His memorial service was actually on one of the days that we did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what song that was. It was one of the songs that we did, the kind of paying homage to that wah-wah guitar sound.
Oh, yeah.
Signature.
Mm-hmm.
Robin managed to channel in on that.
Mm-hmm.
On one of the tunes, I'm not even sure which one it was. But it's really cool how he captures that, because we sat around and talked about Isaac Hayes for a while, and
mm-hmm.
and all of the soul singers that came out of Memphis and still are in Memphis. And it just really it just came together. Chris is a great producer
mm-hmm.
in a way that he brings all of these elements together. Whether it's musicians and great songs and just a feel-good air about being in the studio, and then he gets out of the way.
Uh-huh.
And not a lot of producers allow an artist and musician to do that. And I appreciated that about him.
Mm-hmm.
It was my first time working with him, and it was a pretty good experience. It was a very good experience overall,
mm-hmm.
being that you know, we were able to come together and agree and, you know, and compromise on the individual songs that we ended up with.
Yeah. So this way of, how did you meet him? And so this way of pulling together an album, you know, having, you know, Chris acting as a facilitator, you know, you all talking about vision, and then I guess him, like you say, going to his black book and seeing who he knew that can facilitate your vision. Yeah, compared to other ways that you made your albums, was the process one that you like to repeat?
Oh, you know, I'm one of these people that I try so many different things. That's
mm-hmm.
why it's such a different sound with each record that I put out.
Yeah.
I can't say I would try the same thing just
mm-hmm.
because I don't know if it's just because of the way I was raised, where you raised to be creative,
mm-hmm.
or you put in situations where you have to be creative to get something different started and to keep that fire going.
Mm-hmm.
It's always something different that moves me. And I try to go with that, and that's how I end up in so many different genres, and I end up working with so many different types of people, not
mm-hmm.
just musicians, but types of musicians. I met Chris when I did a CAMI tour, Columbia Artist Management Tour. I was touring with Bo Diddley and Alvin Youngblood Hart.
Wow,
yeah.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah. Chris was a part of the team that put that together.
Oh.
Yeah, so I met him early on during that period.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was behind the second CAMI tour that I did
mm-hmm.
Earlier this year with Robin Ford.
Yeah.
And Jorma Kalkinen.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I have been, talking to each other off and on about music and music that we love and music that we grew up with and how to bring that into these times and still pay homage to the sound, you know, that simple sound back then.
Mm-hmm.
And even just reaching back and calling up some of the musicians, you know, from that period, like Jim Dickinson
mm-hmm.
and folks like Wayne Jackson, who's the leader of the Memphis Horns,
mm-hmm.
and folks like Charlie Hodges, who is responsible for that beautiful B3 intro to Love and Happiness from Al Green.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we call up these guys. He would call and ask me if it's okay if he could, you know, try to get in touch with these folks.
Because
mm-hmm. a lot of these folks, you know, some of them play still, and some of them, you know, they hang around the house until they feel like they want to leave. Well, because they can.
Yes.
And that's the beauty of it. And so I was just thrilled that we got a yes from just about everybody we asked
mm-hmm.
to come up and play with us. I like to look at it that way. Come play with us.
Right. Yeah, that's
we
awesome.
We only had 3 days. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
my.
Pretty much the basic tracks were done in 3 days, and we used a lot of the first and second takes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was some serious, real connecting soul energy going on from the first beat on. And, you know, I have to mention Rock Dietrich, who's the drummer for this.
Yes.
Yeah, and Rock played with, well, he toured with Tracy Chapman.
Mm-hmm. And Ben Harper.
Liz Wright.
Really? Oh, love Liz Wright. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Rock's been around, and he's a great singer, and he's
mm-hmm.
a connection for a lot of L.A. contacts that we needed when we went to do the vocals.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Actually, with some great background vocalists we hear on this CD as well.
Yeah.
And then Larry Fulcher, the bass player. I've known Larry for years. He's
mm-hmm.
toured with Taj Mahal and
mm-hmm.
countless other artists. And Larry lives here in Texas. He lives in the Houston area.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out we brought those two guys together. They were the first to get there in Memphis, and they knew each other from way back when they both lived in L.A., and we had no idea. So getting those two together was like watching two brothers, you know, like family coming together again and getting a chance to talk about old times.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great, but that's amazing that you did this in 3 days.
Yeah, it was a lot of Starbucks coffee. Lots of vegetable plates for Robin and barbecue for the rest of us.
Yeah, wow. You know, the anniversary of Texas, Africans in Texas getting the news about the end of slavery. And your family is indigenous to Texas. Like, do you all go back for generations there?
Yeah, a few generations back. Mississippi is about where my great-great grandfather comes from. Mississippi and Georgia.
Okay.
But for the most part, it's Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty much my family.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then, you know, like you was, Texas does, has produced a lot of really wonderful musicians. I was wondering, sort of, do you feel that sort of those roots, you know, coming up through you into your work, and are there any particular stories that or themes that you want to get across no matter what the incarnation of the particular project is?
Ooh, that's a big question. A couple of questions in there.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the Texas theme, I think it's a real privilege that, you know, get a chance to be from Texas and a plus.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many different sounds that come through here. You know, even Bob Dylan,
mm-hmm.
you know, has been made an honorary Texan. And
that's great.
You know, he talks about that in his last Rolling Stone interview, how he loves that about Texas, where there's just so many different types of music that comes out of this area, this place, and is accepted. You know, we're all exposed here. I grew up being exposed to Tejano and Cajunto,
mm-hmm.
and that's all a part of, you know, your community. And you can't leave Texas without some of that being in you, and at least connected to it when you hear something similar to it anywhere else. I think that's what makes Texas musicians really, really different from any other place. And also what keeps us here. There's a lot of great Texas musicians that just don't leave. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's a big place. You don't have to.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. Are you the second largest state? Is California bigger than Texas?
Yeah, I think it might be. You may have to look in the geographic history.
Yeah.
Look for that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, yeah, as far as the message and, you know, and what I want people to know, I'm not sure. I guess that's what you're getting at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try to keep what I record. Not necessarily personal, but though some of it ends up being that way.
Mm-hmm.
But just something musically and melodically that someone can connect with, you know. And then I'm talking about something deep. It may be just a note on the way something is sung that moves me,
mm-hmm.
you know. And there's always that thing that people talk about Aretha Franklin or any other, you know, great instrumentalist or vocalist. They can sing or play the Chinese menu and it sounds great. It's just something about the way they say what they have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I try to do is just interject what I'm feeling into every note. And if somebody can connect to that, then I know I've done what I'm here to do.
Mhm. Yeah. And so, who are you bringing with you to California?
Oh yeah, you did ask me who I'm on the road with. I'm not on the road with any of the musicians I record with because
mm-hmm.
I let's just say I can't afford them.
Yeah, I would say that would be very expensive.
And yeah, they don't travel as much as they like to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like them to travel.
Right.
I'm traveling with my family band. I have Samantha Banks from Houston on drums. KS.
Yeah, a woman.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, my rhythm section is all women. Yeah, the bass player is my cousin.
Oh.
Found out we're cousins.
You just found out you were cousins.
Yeah, we did. We found out about a year and a half ago that we were cousins.
That's cool.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where somebody goes to a funeral.
Oh.
And, you know, you start talking to people and they ask, what are you doing now? And I'm playing with Ricky Carlson. What are you doing? That's she's seeing the such and such. You should talk to her. Oh, you know, you're what cousin? So it was one of those things. You know, her grandfather was my grandfather's cousin. So we're cousins down the line. So, yeah, Tanya Richardson on bass, and Samantha on drums, and I think, Kate Wolf, I think I'm bringing Scotty Miller. Scotty Miller is from Minneapolis, and he's a keyboard player, D3 extraordinaire, that I met on the Bo Diddley tour.
Oh.
Yeah, he was in Bo's band.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotty has a great solo career himself, playing Barrel House Blues, Chicago Blues, great singer-songwriter, and he's got a new CD coming out as well. We call him Scotty Bones, and he is.
Oh, that is awesome. That's really awesome. Are you working on anything new?
You know, I'm not. I've been traveling so much. I'm really having a great time concentrating on just the ride, you know, having a good time with that. And incorporating all of this new material that I had to learn really quick into my set. Yeah, I'm not writing right now, and it's good. It's a good thing. I know I will real soon because I'm about to have some time off, and I tend to kind of go in and start creating when that happens. But right now, I'm just enjoying the ride.
Yeah. I really like you know, the way the lyrics in Truth, and it's amazing how you know you telling me how you wrote it. I mean, that it was almost like in the moment, and it was the first draft. And there it is, and it's the title track. You know, you talk about how truth isn't hard to find; it's right where you are. And you know, and a lot of these pieces in this particular album, you know, almost tell you, like, just be still for a moment, and whatever you need to be there with you, because it's already there with you. But we're just racing around so much we don't find it, we can't find it. And yeah, I just love Eric Bibb, and I just, like I said, love seeing you all together, and I became an immediate fan of yours.
That's great.
Yeah, so now I've got to get all your CDs, too. So next time we speak, we can talk about, you know, sort of like, sort of do a stroll through, you know, Ruth Foster, your discography.
I'd love that. I really would.
Yeah.
And, I appreciate you getting that, what truth is about. I do still get people who come up to me, and they want me to just tell them what it is, what you're saying. But, you know, truth is, it's in there. It's just, like you said, you stand still long enough, you'll find out who you are and what you're here for, what you're about. And it may be really, really simple. It may surprise you how simple it is.
Yeah, that's what I got too, is that it is simple. We make things harder. But it's not hard at all. Yeah. You know, the song Love in the Middle, you know, with you know, all these great affirmations, you know, that mother told us, and our grandmother, and our grandfather, and our aunties. You know, it's like, yeah, we already know all the things we need to know.
Yeah.
And if we don't know them, somebody else does, and we heard it.
That's right. And yeah, that somebody is real close to you. Somebody you think is gone, but they're still speaking to you in so many ways.
Right. Yeah. It was. And then I really love that line in his in that particular one. You know, sort of stay balanced. You know, keep your love in the middle. And then I just love the one that you have on here. The one I love don't come easy. When it don't come easy, oh my God, that was like my anthem for like a month or two. Because I was going through some stuff, and like. And so I told my partner, like, you need to listen to this song. And I was playing it on my radio show, and I said, you need to tune in and listen to this song.
Yeah,
because, boy, you have some really great stuff on this CD, on this album. It's just it's fabulous.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm glad you're enjoying that.
Yeah, I really am. I really am. And I'm, like, so happy that, you know, we're speaking. And I look forward to meeting. I was too chicken to come up and say hi.
Yeah. You never do that again. Come up and say hi.
Mm-hmm.
It may take a while to get to me sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you had a lot of admirers around. Yeah, but I just sort of stood off to the side and watched them get their autographs and said, oh, man, she was so good. Oh, my God. Yeah, and it went home with that in my heart, and I'm just happy with it, you know?
Well,
thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, and I'm going to be in Austin, so I won't be able to see you when you're in California. But I hope you have a safe journey, and it's a great concert because I know it's going to be fabulous.
Thank you. I look forward to it. And when you're here, have a good time. Enjoy my sound.
Oh, certainly will. It's really beautiful there. It's really nice.
It is.
Yeah, I'm not going to rent a car. I'm going to just learn Austin on my bicycle. I'm going to rent a bike.
Oh, really now?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yes, yes. It's like, okay, we are going to walk and bike. We are not going to drive anywhere.
Yeah, that's a way to get around.